The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Michael Heyman.
Our speaker today spent most of his career in the cloister of academe. Then last September, Ira Michael Heyman became the 10th secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. And promptly, the atomic bomb blasted him into notoriety. Critics charged that the National Air and Space Museum's planned exhibit of the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the atomic bomb on Japan at the end of World War II, was an attempt at revisionism, one that was designed to question the need to use the bomb to end the war. Mr. Heyman quickly recommended to the Smithsonian's regents that the exhibit be canceled, a recommendation that was accepted. In its place, the Air and Space Museum will simply display a section of the Enola Gay's fuselage. Mr. Heyman explained the decision by saying, quote, "We made a basic error in attempting to couple a historical treatment of the use of atomic weapons with the 50th anniversary commemoration of the end of the war." Still, the controversy continues to simmer. Critics have accused Mr. Heyman and the Smithsonian of caving in to political pressure. The secretary faces interrogation next month when he appears before the congressional committees that control his budget. I'm sure he'll get a few practice questions here today. Of the institution's $460 million budget, $371 million comes from the federal government. The Smithsonian complex includes 17 museums and galleries, the National Zoo, plus research facilities in 10 states and the Republic of Panama. A native of New York City, Mr. Heyman graduated from Dartmouth College in 1951. After serving in the Marine Corps for 2 years, he attended Yale University Law School, where he was editor of the Yale Law Review. Mr. Heyman was chief law clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren in 1958-59. Afterward, he began his long career at the University of California at Berkeley, serving as chancellor of that traditionally tranquil campus from 1980 to 1990. He significantly increased the enrollment of minority students at the university. Immediately before taking over at the Smithsonian, Mr. Heyman was here in Washington as Deputy Assistant Secretary to Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. Mr. Heyman is the first non-scientist to head the Smithsonian in its 150-year history. He is here with us today to discuss the future of the Smithsonian, ladies and gentlemen, Michael Heyman.
Well, thanks for this opportunity to come and talk to you about the great institution I have the honor to lead. Had the first month of my tenure been a little quieter, I might have called this my first chance to get to know the press and for you to get to know me as secretary. But we've already been out there on the front lines with the Enola Gay, but this time, at least I got lunch. Most everyone in this room knows that the Smithsonian has just gone through some hard times. Nevertheless, I have enjoyed much of my 5 months as the 10th secretary. Perhaps the cloister at Berkeley prepared me a little bit for the cauldron that I have inherited in Washington. From the moment I was sworn in by the Chief Justice one perfect fall day on the National Mall, to the recent opening of the first stage of the National Museum of the American Indian in New York City, I have been continually amazed by what the Smithsonian contains and what the Smithsonian does. One might imagine from reading the critical editorials and columns of the recent past that the Smithsonian's dominant activity is to put on controversial exhibitions that are seen to question traditional American values. Actually, controversial presentations are a very small portion of the exhibition fair of 17 galleries and museums, our traveling exhibition service, and the zoological park. And while exhibitions are obviously important, a great deal of the institution's efforts involve stewardship of over 140 million historical art and scientific objects, which are the basis of research and publication by Smithsonian scholars and visiting scholars from around the world. Renowned research institutes in astronomy and tropical biology located outside the Washington area, active research undertakings in biological diversity, estuarine studies and conservation of collections, and hosts of public educational programs. The scope of the institution reminds me of the breadth and depth of a great university. Prominent in achieving this breadth and depth are the Smithsonian's unique origins and governance system. James Smithson's legacy to the United States was for an institution devoted to the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Initially, the Smithsonian was primarily devoted to scientific research. Part of this was in physics and part in natural history, enhanced by the government sponsorship of Western exploration, which produced collections of rocks and minerals, fauna and flora, and anthropological materials. These were also the origins of the United States Geological Survey, the Bureau of American Ethnology, and the former Bureau of Biological Survey. Later in the 19th century, the exhibition of natural objects, and still later, products of American technology, became a companion activity. The thrust and style of Smithsonian programs, as they have grown over time, continue to be informed by the basic mission laid down in Smithson's founding instructions. I doubt if this growth, shaped by the creativity of successive secretaries and staff, would have occurred if the Smithsonian were simply a government agency subject to detailed direction by the President and the Congress. Rather, the institution from the outset was treated by the political branches as an independent trust, with trustees, the regents, reflecting membership from the three branches of government, with the Chief Justice of the United States traditionally presiding, and citizens from the District of Columbia and other states chosen by the regents but subject to congressional confirmation. This properly has not buffered the institution from the influence of the purse or the suasion of congressional opinion. It has, however, established a set of implicit ground rules, not unlike those guiding state legislatures in relating to their public universities, under which the institution is expected to make its own judgments concerning the nature of its programs. If new initiatives require federal funding, of course, the Congress rightfully determines whether to make such investments. There are challenges that come with all this breadth and depth. It sounds grand to say that we have collected over 140 million objects, but this includes a responsibility to take care of each one of them, to house them in buildings that are well maintained, to display as many as possible in ways that make sense, to understand them, to share them, and all at a time now when resources are shrinking. Also, we have an obligation not to stand still, to keep on collecting so that our own times go into the national memory vaults, to find exciting ways to share with the American public their treasures, to get off the mall, down home, and online. Those are some of the critical challenges I inherit as the 10th Secretary. There are others. Luckily, I've had the benefit of wise counselors since the beginning of my tenure. Over a year ago, the Smithsonian's Board of Regents asked a group of 26 distinguished Americans from academic, corporate, philanthropic, and professional communities to form a commission on the future of the Smithsonian. The final report is not yet in, but some of their initial insights have stimulated my own thinking about where we need to go. There are at least four areas we need to think about. The first challenge involves the changing nature of American society. America has always been and will continue to be a composite of cultures. But as recently as 1980, 4 in 5 Americans were of non-Hispanic European origin. According to Census Bureau projections for 2050, nearly half of the population will belong to the groups we now call minorities. The challenge this presents to the Smithsonian is the same as presented to all American institutions. Our nation's motto, E Pluribus Unum, is a mandate for inclusion as the basis for unity. The Smithsonian has a major role to play in helping Americans value each other's origins and accomplishments. Out of such come mutual respect and true equality of opportunity. Valuing a culture or a religion or a walk of life or a generation, for that matter, does not require devaluing another. In fact, unity requires just the opposite. In my view, the Smithsonian can use its unique position to serve as a common ground where citizens can experience objects and ideas that bind us together as a nation. These speak louder to our likenesses than to our differences. I do not have to tell you that museums in general, and the Smithsonian in particular, occasionally become flashpoints and controversies about our changing America. The Smithsonian's position is especially difficult because we are the national museum. In my view, however, there should always be room at the Smithsonian to explore important contemporary issues, lest our great potentialities as an educational institution be wasted. However, when we create an exhibition, a program, or even an individual label, we need to do so with great care. We need to distinguish between opinion and fact. We need to contribute to light rather than heat. And we need to avoid instructing people or telling them how to think. Instruction in this sense is not, to my way of thinking, the same as education, which should broaden the people's bases for making choices, not instruct them as to which choices to make. The foregoing leads to the second challenge. The Smithsonian needs to rethink its policy on exhibitions. We are developing guidelines that will establish appropriate parameters for the secretary, for museum directors and curators to collaborate more effectively on the choice and design of exhibitions, the processes for review and intervention, the extent to which historical exhibitions should speak within the context of the time, and ways to assure that our multiple audiences feel that their own ideas are being respected. We are co-sponsoring a conference with the University of Michigan in April, which will explore many of these issues. This brings me to my third point. While there has been a lot of public attention focused on our exhibitions in the last year, we must never forget that the heart of exhibitions is the collections. The Smithsonian's vast collections may be the reason so many of you refer to the Smithsonian as the nation's attic. Some of my colleagues have a real problem with that phrase because it suggests to them musty spaces with no rhyme or reason to the jumble inside. I don't mind it so much since I think it's said with affection. Although I do wish some of you would not take it so literally, my public affairs people actually field requests from media from time to time asking to film in the attic. What we have collected over the years is an amazing array of items. Some are obvious treasures. Some we learned over time were treasures, although we accumulated them by accident. Many are the basis for scientific research, and some are just wonderful things that would have been lost forever were there no Smithsonian. The historical treasures, of course, get the most attention. The desk that Thomas Jefferson used to write the Declaration of Independence, the original Star-Spangled Banner, the Hope Diamond, the Spirit of St. Louis, and yes, even the Enola Gay. To these one-of-a-kind objects add remarkable collections like the National Portrait Gallery's Meserve Collection of Civil War Photographs, which includes the last photograph taken of Lincoln, the Duke Ellington Collection at the National Museum of American History, the Morans and Bierstadts and other canvases of the American West, and our extraordinary collection of American Indian artifacts. These kinds of objects, precious for what they represent and for what they tell us about our past, make the Smithsonian almost a sacred place for the people of the United States. In addition, I'm proud that the Smithsonian Museums were among the first to give people the chance to see their everyday lives and interests presented as museum worthy. The World War II veteran can go to the Smithsonian to see the cot that young draftees like he slept in during that era. His child, or is it his grandchild, can see Fonzie's jacket from the television show Happy Days. And there's a model of the Starship Enterprise of Star Trek fame at the Air and Space Museum. Going to the Smithsonian is like discovering that you've been speaking prose for your entire life. History is not someone else's life, someone else's taste. It's yours as well. Although I've got to say that there are some risks in that for the average American of my age. It's a bit strange to walk into a museum and see things you remember from your younger days out on display along with a Conestoga wagon. I'm saying all this because I feel that the Smithsonian has been at its best when it thought big, or at least wide, in collecting policy, when it took some risks collecting more rather than less, or when it was open to the idea that an object was important to gather for the benefit of future generations. A broad collection policy is not just relevant to our history and art museums. Our most incredible collection that has proved useful in ways beyond anything we imagined is at the National Museum of Natural History. In the words of the Commission on the Future of the Smithsonian, that collection represents the largest available amount of information on the past and present distribution of our country's flora and fauna. Collecting began well over a century ago, and the uses we have put them to would have been unimaginable to the original collectors. One use, for example, is a source of DNA for characterizing many threatened species. Yet it was only in the mid-20th century that we came to understand that DNA is the fundamental genetic material of life. Who can predict the future well enough to know what uses these and other collections will have 100 years from now? I have to admit that it's getting pretty crowded with all these burgeoning, increasingly useful collections throughout the institution. You might be thinking that as the nation's attic, it's supposed to be crowded. Maybe we should just build a few more storage facilities in the suburbs, put a few restrictions on our pack rat tendencies, and call it a day. I say that is exactly what we should not do. A static Smithsonian could never serve a dynamic America. Clearly, we have real resource problems to solve if our collections are to grow at a reasonable rate. This will involve taking a hard look at what our strengths are going with them to the exclusion of other temptations. It will also involve being very cautious about new commitments to major construction or new collecting areas and a reassessment of present uses of space. Moreover, we need to think about what we display, how better to provide access to, or at least information about, all that's packed away, and the possibilities of sharing collections with the museums around the country. Most importantly, we must seek new sources of revenue, probably in the private sector, although that too will require that we set priorities. The future is not just about challenges that need to be met. It is also about extraordinary possibilities within our grasp. This leads me to our fourth challenge. The Smithsonian of the future should broaden access to its collections immensely across the nation and around the world. While increasing numbers of visitors come to the mall each year, we recognize that many Americans can never get here, and those who do can manage the trip at best once or twice in a lifetime. The Smithsonian's usefulness to our citizens should not be just about that one class visit in the 10th grade, although I'm sure you, like me, still remember your field trip. Without taking on the impossible, expensive, and unnecessary task of building versions of the Smithsonian around the country, we must find ways to deliver to the American people, wherever they live, the wonders of the institution they have supported for 1.5 centuries. One of my first decisions as secretary was to authorize the creation of an exhibition of some of the institution's treasures that we can take around the country beginning in our 150th anniversary year, 1996. With the aid of corporate support, which we're now seeking, we will bring America's Smithsonian to a location near you. Moreover, the Smithsonian Institution's Traveling Exhibition Service, which has brought hundreds of exhibitions to big and small towns throughout the nation, will continue to get my full support. And there is the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra, with both public and private support behind it. This extraordinary program celebrates the history of American jazz in performances around the country. Most importantly, however, we must harness advanced information technologies to take the Smithsonian into American homes and schools. I have made this a priority of my tenure. Within a few months, the Smithsonian will go online on the internet with a full, constantly up-to-date information service with home pages for our museums and research centers. This will become a Smithsonian without walls, bringing our vast resources home to Americans and offering a perennial field trip for students young and old. The reach of availability should increase considerably in the near future as the private sector merges means of communication and provides access to ordinary homes throughout the country. I am told that one day soon emerging technologies will allow online visitors to look at 3D images and, in essence, hold an item in their hands, turning it through all its dimensions. We have already made plans to open a trial 3D digitizing lab at the National Zoo to test the possibilities for the entire Smithsonian. What better way to get a jump start on the Museum of the Future? I have to admit to you, it's not the technology itself that excites me personally. I'm still addicted to my yellow legal pad. Rather, I'm excited by what the technology can mean to us in extending the reach of our historic mission, the increase in diffusion of knowledge. At the heart of the information revolution is something far more than an advance in technology. It is the fulfilling of one central promise of democracy, to make knowledge available to as many citizens as possible and to allow that access to be shaped by their needs. I see it as James Smithson's mandate, reborn for a new century and a new generation of Americans. Online exhibitions can do things we cannot do through conventional means. Take, for example, the major exhibition Ocean Planet, which will open at the Museum of Natural History in April before going off on a national tour. I'm sure that no one who actually visits the exhibit will easily forget the experience. It is state of the art in the presentation of important questions regarding the health of Earth's oceans. Noteworthy, however, is that this is the first exhibition that we are developing in parallel form online. That prototype will be available over the internet. The online version will feature an interactive floor plan of the exhibition and will incorporate all of its elements. Its resource room will provide an interactive bulletin board and instantaneous connections, I think they're called hot links, to many other sources of oceanographic information available on the Internet. It will also feature a variety of special programs, including discussion sessions, demonstrations, curricula for elementary and high school courses, and meet the curator's opportunities in real time. New information technologies will also affect research. For instance, we're putting in digital form systematic collections of biological information, which can be shared among scientific researchers worldwide. Trips to Washington will be less necessary for access to the collections. Another example is astronomy from afar. The Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory maintains a number of excellent telescopes in Arizona that survey the cosmos on various wavelengths, including optical. A new array is scheduled for Hawaii. Astronomical information used to be collected on photographic plates, examined by astronomers on site. Now the data are collected electronically, viewed on screens, and the astronomer can be at a location remote from the telescope. All that's needed is voice communication with the telescope operator to assure proper alignment and the like. Meeting the challenges that I've outlined is a heady task. I clearly cannot do this by myself. The days when one of my predecessors could be called with great affection the Emperor of them all are long over. I must engage the whole of the Smithsonian family in dealing positively with the changing nature of American society, with devising and following appropriate general guidelines for exhibitions that largely are to be applied by museum directors, with assuring continued collection vitality to serve a dynamic and growing America, and to explore and exploit the new electronic technologies, which will impact profoundly both exhibition and research, and produce an enormous increase in access to the Smithsonian. You may wonder why I'm so upbeat after a recent burst of controversy. As I tell my staff, we need to remember that much of the criticism leveled at the Smithsonian comes from people whose expectations of us are high. They want us to represent the best. They invest a great deal in a national place committed to the increase and diffusion of knowledge as a challenge to narrower ideas of American purpose. That's why I took the job, and I intend to be worthy of it. Thank you.
Thank you. On the way to the podium, I mentioned to our guest that he perhaps should be ready for some more Enola Gay questions, and he said, no, I don't think so. That's in the past. Well, the first questioner asked if it's possible for you to separate yourself from your official position and express a personal view on the cancellation of the Enola Gay exhibit.
That's pretty tough for me. You have to understand that for 35 years, I taught in a great university and I administered a great university. And that part of me says we should have hung in there. But then I'm a former Marine, or should I say I'm a Marine who used to be on active duty.
Nearly a month has passed since your announcement of the cancellation. Have you defined further what the new exhibit will consist of, and will it open in May of 1995?
Well, the target date is May, but if it slipped over to June, I wouldn't be terribly surprised. I did a rather unprecedented thing. I took personal responsibility for the new exhibition. Obviously, I'm working with folk in the castle to help me, and with exhibition folk in air and space. Obviously, we will show the object, which is the forward portion of the fuselage. We'll have some contextual labels, and I was talking with an eminent historian the other day
and he said that at least he would read whatever I wrote. We might well give some examples of the activities that went into our restoration of the Enola Gay, and perhaps have some other portions of it on exhibit. And we are considering seriously the use of videos, some wonderful videos that were put together in the last year of crew members in the 509th Composite Group, whose conversations with regard to their training and their mission are not nearly as straightforward as some people might imagine. I don't know what the composite of all of that will be, but I must say it's a great test of our ingenuity.
When the exhibit does open, will Martin Harwit, the director of the National Air and Space Museum, still be the director of the National Air and Space Museum?
I'd be extraordinarily surprised if he were not. You know, it's characteristic in business, and it's characteristic in government agencies often, that if there's an error made, especially if it's viewed as a large error, that we cut off the head of whoever is the head of that entity, and somehow that makes us either feel better or retribution solves what the problem is. I'm not really of that mind. I'm of the mind that you don't punish people for a single mistake, and you certainly don't punish people in the midst of emotional stress and political heat. On the other hand, I do have a responsibility as the new secretary of the Smithsonian to make sure that the National Air and Space Museum is structured correctly, is being well run, and that it really works, that its mission is properly defined internally and the like. We have are in the midst of, or I think have now through the undersecretary, commissioned a good study of both the museum and its leadership by an independent entity from outside. That'll be a very thorough review. What the result of that's going to be, both in terms of the structure of governance at Air and Space and the people who run it, I'm not sure. But whatever it is, it's going to be done with real deliberation and with great care.
Questioner wants to know why you let the media, of all people, set up a confrontation or a conflict between emotional legionnaires on the one hand, dispassionate curators on the other hand, and not call in respected military historians to help you decide the issue.
Well, it's a little hard for me to answer because by the time I came, the processes had been well formed. Why that didn't occur at an earlier time, I have theories about it, but I'm not really absolutely sure, and I presume that the study that I'm commissioning will give us more information with regard to that. But by the time I came there, a first draft, which I must say was quite provocative, had gone public through the media. I must say that one of the things that I'm becoming quite educated about is that with all the new technologies and with the proliferation of people who are in the media, a single provocative statement gets made or a single provocative article gets written, and it spreads worldwide almost immediately and continues to be repeated. I haven't learned enough yet to know how to deal with that phenomenon, except to be very, very careful. The Air and Space Museum was not very, very careful in permitting all of this to go public at what I what I believe was a premature time. I think by the time I came here, the idea of bringing in dispassionate people to referee the conflict was long past. What's that it had been done at an earlier time.
Are you planning any activities with the Japanese to explore in a more objective way the impact of the Enola Gay?
We have no conversations or plans going on presently. Perhaps when we eventually do a program, I'm not sure it's going to be an exhibition, but a program on the events surrounding the use of atomic weapons, perhaps that, and that'll be sometime in the future, perhaps that would be a time to take on that initiative.
You mentioned that symposia on the issue of the use of atomic weapons that enraged critics of the Enola Gay. Why would the symposia be any more appropriate than the exhibition?
I think there are a lot of ways that we at the Smithsonian, as well as others, can search through and evaluate complex historical events. I'm not sure that exhibitions with great wall plaques of words are the best way. I think that maybe the best way is really to bring people of different viewpoints together and in moderated sessions have them interact with one another and answer one another when one makes an assertion, another makes a response, and it continues in that mode. I'm not sure that exhibitions on the walls of museums permit that kind of depth or that kind of complexity of conversation. I, at least in my own mind presently, believe that we would go forward more in the way of dialogue or many people speaking. I think that in general we can do that quite easily. I think that with any care we can make that not uncontroversial, but one that's quite acceptable to multiple audiences. I might just say in general that I don't think we should eschew controversial exhibitions. I don't think we should have that as necessarily the only thing we do, but I think we can do quite controversial exhibitions if we're very careful about how we do them. And I think one of the problems was that with the Enola Gay exhibition, that not sufficient care was taken to do it in that careful way that would have avoided quite a lot of the collisions of emotion that otherwise occurred.
Those were the easy questions. Given the fact that the new Congress is considering budget cuts all across the board, including the Smithsonian, are there new sources of funding that you see out there? You mentioned the corporate world, number one. Several questioners asked whether you might consider charging admission as another source of funding.
Well, my experience at Berkeley is really helpful in this regard. As you know, public universities in general and the University of California in particular have gone through very rough fiscal times in terms of state funding. And their response has been multiple. A part of it recently has been to increase fees to an unprecedented height. I would really like to avoid admissions charges to the Smithsonian Museums. If we're absolutely strangled, then of course we will have to consider them with care. But I would like to avoid them for all of the reasons that are obvious. If we start using admissions fees, it means that we're going to become more and more selective with regard to those who come, those who can afford to come, those who make the marginal choice to come or not. And I think that would be a shame. I think that what we want to do is to be as inclusive as we possibly can, to have as many people come as do. You know, we get 28 or 29 million visits a year. Air and space, for instance, with all of this controversy, perhaps in part because of some controversy, is the most visited museum in the world. It gets about 8.5-9 million people a year. It's an extraordinary event. I don't want to dampen that. I really don't want to dampen that. But it might come to pass that just like the University of California, we have to charge user fees in order to be able to sustain the basic activities of the institution. Another thing I learned at Berkeley, however, was that the potentialities of getting private support are much greater than one otherwise would think. When I became chancellor at Berkeley, we were obviously involved in fundraising, but it was not done in really a highly professional way. And In the course of the 10 years that I was there, we went from $7 or $8 or $9 million a year to over $100 million a year. We had a very successful campaign, which really helped us to organize getting money. Nobody ever thought that the alumni of a public university would give money because, after all, they pay taxes. That was absolutely incorrect, and people would. I think the Smithsonian has great opportunity to do the same. And we're going to put a lot of attention in trying to raise the amount of giving from private individuals and to continue the kind of corporate support that we've gotten, especially for exhibitions. I don't think that this is a substitute for public funding. It helps at the margin, but of course, if we take terrible hits publicly in terms of public financing, then we'll have to think of other alternatives, which really mean shrinkage. And at the moment, I don't find any real candidates for shrinkage that would produce enough money so that it would matter in terms of the sustenance of the important activities of the Smithsonian.
Do you view the cuts in your budget regarding the Indian Museum as motivated by spending constraints or by opposition to multiculturalism?
I don't have any reason to believe that the suggested rescissions that came out of the subcommittee of the Interior Subcommittee of Appropriations yesterday in the House are motivated by anti-multiculturalism. The chairman of the House subcommittee in the past has been somewhat skeptical of the size and some of the functions that we have planned for a resource center in relationship to the museum out on at Suitland, Maryland, in the suburbs, as I indicated in my speech. I think that skepticism is probably at the heart of the action that was taken yesterday. Let me say that there's a lot to go before that action has a bind. We've got to go through the House Appropriations Committee, where I think we can make a number of very good arguments, not the least being that when the National Museum of the American Indian was originally authorized by Congress, there was an understanding that the Smithsonian had to raise some considerable amount of money to match federal contribution to especially the museum on the Mall that's contemplated for about 2001. We've already raised practically all the money we're supposed to raise under that legislation. It would be a terrible shame, in my view, now to give up on something where the Congress, as well as the Smithsonian, really has made a pledge that if private support can be raised to a third of the total cost of the museum on the Mall, two-thirds will come from the federal government. I think those arguments are going to prevail. But as with everything else these days, given the desire to reduce budgetary expenditures at the federal level, it'll be a struggle.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.